World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. This program is presented in behalf of Admiral dealers all over America by shortwave broadcast direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country. CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefront. Now, here's Robert Clough.
A small force of B-29s crossed over Japan's inland sea today and dropped high explosive bombs on the synthetic oil plant at Uba, a town on the southwestern tip of Honshu Island. Between 75 and 100 superfortresses took part in the raid, their first blow at Japan since last Friday. The Tokyo Radio says that some 200 Mustang fighter planes were also over Honshu today, attacking air bases and communications. General George Kenney, commander of the Far Eastern Air Force, reveals that an air terminal has now been established on Okinawa. The other end of the military airline is Melbourne, Australia, 6,400 miles away. Planes are making regular flights, taking less than 48 hours for the trip. The first direct redeployment of United States troops from France to the Pacific was completed when some 5,000 American soldiers stepped ashore at Manila more than a month after sailing from the French Mediterranean port of Marseille. The Southeast Asia Command today reports a new Japanese offensive. Several thousand Japanese troops caught in a pocket in Burma, north of Rangoon, have broken out of the trap in a powerful drive by which the Japanese may hope to escape into Siam. In Paris, Marshal Pétain arrived in a prison van at the Palace of Justice, where he will live in a four-room suite adjoining the tiny courtroom in which his trial begins tomorrow. In Potsdam, the Big Three conference continued with a business session held this Sunday afternoon. For the details, Admiral takes you now to Berlin, Richard C. Hottolett reporting.
The three-power conference at Potsdam has finished its first week. It would be good to draw up an interim balance, see how many and what kind of questions have been brought up for discussion and how many of them have been settled. That would give the best reply to the question all of us are asking, just how is the conference going? But we can't pretend to give you this. We just don't know. We do know that the Committee of Foreign Ministers has been meeting every morning, and the Big Three themselves getting together every afternoon, that staffs and experts of all kinds have produced a thousand little facts and figures to guide the decisions up on top. We're told that serious and constructive work has been accomplished. We know that the range of the conference is vast, and the different kinds of people have been brought together for it. And it does seem as if the people of the three nationalities who meet together also get along together, which is fundamental. Three people who hate each other's guts can be polite and smile nicely at a photographer, but they can't get any work done that'll stick. It was President Truman himself in his short talk the other day who indicated the spirit in which the talks are going ahead. He emphasized peace and reconstruction, underlined the necessity of using the tremendous mobilized strength of the three great powers to build the future. And he said, that is what we propose to do. You got the impression that the we included Stalin and Churchill. You get the feeling about this conference that no one is forcing the pace. Whatever decisions emerge will not be hastily patched together. If on the agenda there are matters that can't be settled quickly, they'll be settled slowly, or, if necessary, put off to the next Big Three conference. You get the impression that all concerned are deeply aware of their responsibility, that they want whatever they say here to stick. This is not a hurried affair. The pace is deliberate. While there don't seem to have been any holdups, it doesn't appear as if it'll be over this week. It'll probably run longer even than Yalta. From various odd sources, one gets the impression that political questions have had full priority this past week, namely the Allied administration of Germany. And you don't get the feeling that anything very sensational will be sprung either in this or in world questions. And that holds for Russia's declaration of war against Japan, too. The United Nations victory in the Pacific is in a foregone conclusion. Russia is mainly interested in the political future of China, Manchuria, Mongolia. And she's got a powerful hand there without fighting. The big military people, by the way, at the conference have had so much time for sightseeing and for military ceremonies here that you somehow don't think they've been too busy. Well, you can speculate until you run out of breath on just what's being discussed and how. But it's too bad that when you sit down and analyze what you really know about the conference, you find it's very little. It's unpleasant for a reporter to try to sum up so important and big a story in terms mainly of his own impressions. Negotiations can well be kept secret, but there's really no reason why facts should be. Why we shouldn't be told now some details, even of what's been accomplished in Potsdam this past week. It goes much deeper than our own profession. After all, the big three are the executive arm of any world organization. Their meetings are bound to be held regularly. And it's the practice in a democracy, if we want democracy, to get much more of a progress report from the executive. And this is Richard C. Hadlett in Berlin, returning you to Admiral from New York.
Next, a word from Warren Sweeney.
Have you written to Admiral for your free copy of a new 16-page booklet called It's a Promise from Admiral? If not, why don't you mail a penny postcard today? All you do is write It's a Promise, together with your name and address, and send it to Admiral in care of the radio station to which you are now listening. Admiral prepared this booklet so you can see pictures of the products we've been talking so much about. The new Admiral automatic record changer with only 3 moving parts, the Admiral dual-temp refrigerator that is 2 refrigerators in one, the Admiral electric range that makes automatic cooking a reality, the Admiral home freezer that'll be the answer to all your problems about the freezing and storing of frozen foods. You'll see them all and read all about them in this brand new booklet, It's a Promise from Admiral. All you do to get your copy is write It's a Promise together with your name and address on a penny postcard and mail it to Admiral in care of this station. Write today. You'll get it right away. It's a Promise from Admiral. Now here once again is Robert Trout.
Now for an interview with one of our fighting men who's been using a new cannon in the Philippines campaign, Admiral takes you after a brief pause to CBS Manila, Don Pryor reporting.
To many a soldier whose address soon will be a foxhole somewhere in Japan when the big push comes, the biggest news this week was about 2 guns. What they are is heavy artillery that a soldier can carry right into the front lines. And here's the man who first tested them in actual combat, Sergeant John Latham of New York City. What about these guns, John?
Oh, they're wonderful. What they are is just a 57-millimeter gun, like an anti-tank gun, and a 75-millimeter cannon, only they haven't any recoil.
It sounds fishy.
Yes, I know, but they haven't. You can fire the 57 from your shoulder, and it won't even jar you.
Well, how about the 75?
That's too heavy to fire from the shoulder. We put that on a 30-caliber machine gun mount.
I wonder if you can understand just what that means. These guns are so light that one man can carry the 57 and 2 men the 75. It means that doughboys themselves can now fire really powerful artillery right into the face of Japanese positions instead of sneaking up on them with rifles and flamethrowers. Right, John?
That's right.
Well, tell us about the tests you made with them.
That was several months ago. We took a short course to learn how to operate them, and then we took them into the assault on Ipoh Dam.
Ipoh Dam, I might explain, is the principal source of Manila's water supply. And the successful battle to recapture it intact was one of the most bitter of the Luzon campaign. How did you operate with your walkie-talkie artillery, John?
Well, the various battalion commanders would call me when they had targets for us. Pillboxes, caves, or other strong points. The kind of positions that usually cost a lot of lives to take. And we'd bring up our guns and knock them out.
Just like that, huh?
Yes, really. I tell you, they're wonderful guns. We could lay them right into a cave entrance at much better than 1,000 yards. Right at the heat of the fight, for instance, they called us up to work on 6 caves in a row along the side of the hill that formed the main Jap defense line. We knocked out 3 of them in 3 minutes. It's that easy.
And boy, what they wouldn't have given for some of those weapons on Iwo Jima or Okinawa.
Yes, I'm sure they would have saved a lot of lives there. They saved a lot for us just in that one big battle. And I'm sure that they'll save many, many more when the next big push comes. I think they're the answer to cave warfare.
Well, then let's hope we have plenty of them when the time comes.
Yeah, if we have, I'm sure that I and all the rest of us will get home sooner than we would without them.
John's very anxious to get home, too, because he has a lot of plans.
This fighting business isn't quite his line.
Well, fighting's in anybody's line when you're in it, Don.
Well, that's very nice. But in civilian life, John's a writer. Among other things, he used to write radio adaptations for programs acted and directed by Orson Welles and broadcast on the Columbia Network. Now he has a new project. He's working on a play which he hopes to produce on Broadway when that great day comes.
It's not just a hope.
We're going to produce it.
We? Yes, seven of us. We've been putting money aside in a special fund for the last 14 months just for that purpose. And when the war's over, we're going to print the whole thing. It's all set up.
Well, are the others in the Army, too?
Well, they were. We were all part of a special service outfit at Fort Ord. Six of us came overseas together.
Well, John, let's hope that all six of you go home again very soon. That your new walkie-talkie gun wins the war in a hurry. And that your play outruns Tobacco Road. This is Don Pryor in Manila. I return you to Admiral in New York.
This is a big week in Britain as that nation looks forward to learning the election results. Admiral takes you now to London. Douglas Edwards reporting.
Today is the beginning of a big week for Britain. On Thursday, they count the votes, and the fate of Prime Minister Churchill's National Conservative government should be known by late afternoon London time. Mr. Churchill and Mr. Attlee will fly back to London probably on Wednesday to be on hand when the final tally comes in. Political circles here believe that no matter what the result, they both will return to Berlin unless it's decided in the meantime to adjourn the talks to a later date. Wise men over here are still declining to make an out-and-out prediction on the results of the election, beyond the guess that the Prime Minister and his party will be returned with a small majority, but a workable majority just the same. Labour reportedly believes it will gain greatly increased parliamentary strength, and that any government will have seriously to reckon with it, and the Liberals say they're making progress, and that a Liberal revival is on the way. In the past few days, there's been a steady increase in the amount of news from the Pacific the London press has given its readers. Up to now, it's been rather hard to find much mention of the Pacific War in most papers, the BBC being the best and fairest source of information on the Jap struggle. But today, the Far Eastern War gets prominent play on the front pages of all the London papers. They report the story of the American surrender call to Japan and that Admiral Halsey is preparing a new attack. There's also a good bit of speculation on the strength the Japs will be able to muster to cope with an invasion of their homeland. And there's a report from Melbourne saying that Singapore is likely to be freed soon. That story has it that Lord Louis Mountbatten, the supreme commander in Southeast Asia, made plans for the liberation of Java and Malaya during his conference with General MacArthur in Manila. The end of the Burma campaign, which probably won't be long coming, once the monsoon season is over, will enable the British 14th Army to turn south. That'll be the signal for the final stages of the reconquest of Singapore. Well, nobody knows for sure, but London still hears that President Truman will visit this city, despite reports to the contrary. There have been reports he would stay at Buckingham Palace. Now we understand that this state visit to the palace may not be possible, but the president is expected to at least drop in on London. The only other American president who has ever visited Britain was President Wilson, who came to London on his way to the Versailles Peace Conference at the close of the First World War. This is Douglas Edwards in London, returning you to Admiral in New York.
A CBS correspondent has reached Italy on his way home from an air trip that will total 41,000 miles. For his report, Admiral takes you now to CBS Rome. Harry W. Flannery reporting.
In one of the most unusual trips to the European and Pacific theaters, I've been fortunate enough to see the almost forgotten GI working in jungle swamps, monsoon mud holes, across cloud-tipped mountains, and in steaming temperatures of far over 100 degrees. I've met spam with Negro truck drivers who move supplies to China over highways and circle into breathtaking heights and plunge into jungle valleys along the Stillwell Road. We've talked with bronze enlisted men as they landed from Bonnet and Casablanca on their way back to Iowa, Georgia, and Vermont via Army Transport Command planes. We watched Indian labor supervised by American enlisted men recondition the C-46s, C-47s, and C-54s that dare the hump in all weathers. They've gone back and forth over the hump ourselves through the monsoon. I've ridden in jeeps over part of the winding roads fringing deep chasms along the Stillwell Road. We've seen American servicemen train Chinese to operate 105 and drive and service trucks over the most bumpy and treacherous terrain in my experience. We've scanned the skies of Chekiang, waiting long minutes with the crews for the last Chinese pilot of a Chinese-American crew to come back from a mission cutting Japanese communication and supply lines in the corridor, so the Japanese have been forced to shorten their lines in China. Some of us have seen Chinese veterans of the Shanghai campaign, some barefooted, almost all ragged, most old and tired, striding by proudly with tanks and horse-drawn cannons from the last war. We've also seen fresh young Chinese troops shouldering American rifles, riding modern American trucks, gun caissons, jeeps, and weapons carriers. At one spot, we saw 10,000 Chinese trudging with baskets of earth balanced on shoulder poles over wide hilly acres leveling ground for an airstrip. There were so many ants in a scene that paled the most extravagant Hollywood version. Some of us went with Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek and his second son, Major Chiang Wei-kyu, to the Yellow Riverfront at Tung Wan. We traveled in a special train, like a 1900 American type, and 20 miles more over sliding, twisty, dusty roads, with the last miles along a secret highway cut here through steep clay hills. We wandered through a labyrinth of underground and open trenches from which we watched the Japanese across the river. We talked with Japanese prisoners taken in patrol actions across the stream. In Italy, we've seen the indescribable ruin that marked the bloody fight at Cassino. At Kandy, in tropically lush Ceylon, we talked with Lord Louis Mountbatten and the deputy commander, General Weaver. In China, we were given interviews by General Wetemeyer, the Generalissimo, a famous southern Chinese war leader, Marshal Chang Fok Wei, the Chinese Supreme Commander, General Ho, General Chenault, and Ambassador Hurley. I talked in German with a few members of the Chinese 8th Route Army from the north. In India, General Stilton, Merrill of the Marauders, Pick, who built the Stillwell Road, sometimes affectionately called Pick's Pike. In Italy, we talked over Italian affairs with Prime Minister Ferruccio Parri, Prince Umberto, the Chief of the Allied Commission in Italy, Admiral Stone, Ambassador Alexander Kirk, and General McNarney, the Deputy Supreme Allied Commander of the Mediterranean Theater. We heard the first papal pronouncement on journalistic morals in an audience with Pope Pius XII. Among predictions from high sources is that the Japanese may be overcome within 6 months. With a more efficiently operating supply system into and through China and more understanding cooperation, there's evidence and welcomes given by Chinese leaders and people applauding, crying Ding Hao with upraised thumb, that the war and post-war picture is bright in China. There's still need for more supplies there. What appears to be a certainty that Italy, without sufficient coal and raw materials, black markets and restlessness, threatens this winter to break into disorders that may reach revolt proportions unless Allied troops remain to maintain order. Next to northern Italy and Germany. This is Harry W. Flannery in Rome. I return you to Admiral in New York.
In this country, the Senate tomorrow starts debate on the United Nations Charter. For a summary of what the Capitol expects of this debate, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
One day this week, a clerk of the United States Senate will drone off the names of members. There will be a monotonous repetition of eyes, perhaps a few no's, echoing across the high-domed, gloomy chamber. The United States, through this action, will become a member of the United Nations organization. This will be a definite break with the past. Even 4 years ago, when the flames of war were beginning to lick around the world, few here would dare forecast that the Senate would, in their time, agree to American participation in a world organization. One man who dared dream of this future is now dead, his body lying beneath a plot of bright green grass at Hyde Park, Franklin Roosevelt. Another is recovering from a long and hard illness, Cordell Hull. Today, their dreams are far more than a bright hope. They are a reality, backed by all but a few members of the Senate. Just how many votes will be cast against the United Nations Charter is hard to say, but probably not more than five, possibly only one. There are a few senators who want to know how far the American delegate can go in committing our armed forces to attacking aggressor nations. The Washington Post today suggests three limitations some senators may wish to put on the authority of our delegate. First, limiting American forces to action in the Western Hemisphere. Second, a demarcation of the power of the president to use troops and the power of Congress to declare war. And third, a flat requirement that Congress be required to act before the United Nations can use a single American unit to stop aggression. The Post article says the administration may consent to some concessions in the first two points. But the Post adds, the administration will never consent to binding United Nations action to a vote of Congress. Many officials here are confident that another step in Big Three unity will be taken at Potsdam, with a joint announcement spelling out what Japan may expect under unconditional surrender. I return you to Admiral in New York.
The Chinese High Command announces that four Chinese columns in a wide encircling drive are closing steadily on the former American 14th Air Base city of Guilin, and one column is only 9.5 miles from that city. The rumors and reports concerning Japan that have been sweeping through Washington all week reached a high point this weekend. Today, a great deal of interest was aroused by the broadcast to Japan by Navy Captain Zacharias, who was introduced to Japanese listeners as an official spokesman of the United States government when he warned the enemy to surrender unconditionally at once or else prepare for the destruction of everything that supports the Japanese war potential. As a matter of fact, Captain Zacharias, a Navy officer familiar with Japan since 1920, has been broadcasting similar messages to Japan regularly. This is the 12th broadcast so far. And what's chiefly remarkable about it is that this one was made public, while the first 11 were not. However, the Office of War Information says there's no particular significance in this. The talk was made available to the public because the OWI has been receiving questions about what Captain Zacharias has been saying to the enemy in his broadcast series. But whatever the reason for publicizing this talk, the deep interest that it has instantly aroused today is another reflection of the belief in this country that big news about Japan is now being made and will shortly be revealed. There's almost no end to the speculation on what that news will prove to be. The guesses flow out of Washington and out of Potsdam, too. And Tokyo shows signs of curiosity. Yesterday, the Tokyo radio said that American public opinion would force President Truman to retreat from his demand for unconditional surrender. Today, the Japanese propaganda writers appear somewhat more belligerent. Tokyo is broadcasting an editorial from the Nippon Times, saying that the Japanese are reasonable people, amenable to fair arguments, but they are also firm, and they cannot be intimidated. The bombing of Japan, says the enemy, has convinced the Japanese more strongly than ever before that they have a sacred mission to perform. And now to tell you about an electric range with two full-sized ovens, here is Warren Sweeney.
One of the several post-war Admiral electric ranges will have two full-sized ovens, both with automatic temperature controls. Think of the convenience of having two roomy ovens for your everyday cooking and baking. The two ovens in this new Admiral range will be simple to operate. There'll be nothing difficult about cooking with this new two-oven Admiral. They'll be so easy to clean and keep clean, too. Both ovens in the Admiral range will have lighted interiors. The Admiral oven doors will be counterbalanced. They just don't slam. Yes, you'll really fall in love with this new Admiral electric range with two full-sized ovens. Remember, too, the Admiral will be the ranges with flexo heat and full vision controls. But there are so many features about the new Admiral electric ranges that we just can't cover them all. May we urge you to send today for your free copy of Admiral's new, fascinating booklet, It's a Promise, from Admiral. Just write, It's a Promise, together with your name and address on a penny postcard, and mail it to Admiral in care of this radio station. Just write, It's a Promise, your name and address, and mail it to this radio station. You'll enjoy your vacation more this summer if you spend it at home. Travel is tough. Military traffic will make even greater demands upon the nation's transportation system, with casualties being returned to hospitals and to their homes, and many thousands of servicemen and women coming home on rotation furlough and leave. So let's all give them the breaks they deserve and spend our own vacations close to home. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, and post-war makers of Admiral dual-temp refrigerators, Admiral home freezers, Admiral electric ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is the WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.